Well, I may be a silly faggot, but you know something, Mel? You're a cunt.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Before we get started, we need to ask you a favor, and that's to subscribe. It's free, doesn't cost you anything, and we could also use some ratings and reviews if you got a minute or two.
Especially five-star reviews.
We love those.
You can also follow up discussions about today's episode on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillQueerAF.
This episode is called Drugs, Sex, and Lies. All the things we hold dear.
Yes.
It's episode number 12 of season 3. Only two more after this one in this season.
Season 3 is flying by. Drugs, Sex, and Lies first aired in the U.S. on June 8th, 2003.
That was my birthday.
Did you have Drugs, Sex, and Lies on your birthday in 2003?
I looked back in my journal. I've been journaling since I was a kid, and I had no entry on that day. So I don't know what was going on in my life on June 8th in 2003.
I guess you were too busy celebrating your birthday to watch the episode.
Well, it would have been a Sunday, so I'm not sure. Drugs, Sex, and Lies was directed by a Queer as Folk veteran, David Wellington. This is his 6 of 8 episodes. We don't see Wellington's work again, though, until season 5.
Michael McLennan was assigned the teleplay for this one, and Cohen and Lippman wrote the story. He wrote 14 episodes of Queer as Folk, and this is his 8th, so a little more than halfway through. He also wrote 2 episodes of Peter Page's show, The Fosters, which I highly recommend.
Your favorite.
I'm a huge fan of it. And also, one of the younger stars of the show may or may not have a sex tape out there.
Ooh, which one?
We'll talk after the episode, okay. After we record, Patrick.
Here's what happened in Drugs, Sex, and Lies from Queer as Folk, the book.
Ted returns from Palm Springs and apologizes to the girls, even though Emmett has already replaced the money. Emmett refuses to admit that there's a problem, even when Ted convinces Emmett to join him in some crystal meth.
We read these verbatim from the book, and I just wanted to note that first thing there. Apologies to the girls.
Girls,
I just got to trip up over that. Hunter reveals that he knew a dumpster boy, Jason Kemp, and saw the kid go off with the cop who could have killed him. Debbie goes to Horvath, but he tells her that Stockwell cold cased it. Hold on. He didn't tell her that.
He was told cagey about it. He was told that it was cold case, but we'll get into it in the episode. Brian enlists Hunter and Justin's help to discover the identity of the cop, but Hunter changes the plan and goes off on his own with the guy.
The guy. Drugs, Sex, and Lies has an IMDb viewer rating of 8.5. That's on the high end for this season. And interestingly, the demographic that it scored highest in was women, 45 and older. Hmm. Another interesting fact is that 43% of the people rating this episode gave it a 10.
Overall, I was a big fan of this episode.
Would you have given it a 10?
I wouldn't have given it a 10. I think that's a little generous.
8.5?
I think 8.5 is very fair for this episode.
The A story was what I call Brian the Gumshoe.
Say.
Yeah. This is where Brian becomes a noir private dick. And
private big dick.
And goes out on his own to make amends and try to find who killed Dumpster Boy. But first, this episode opened with a Babylon scene that I really liked. And there's a song playing called Baby's Got a Temper by The Prodigy. That song just screams early 2000s. I loved it so much.
And I was also a huge fan of the way Babylon was filmed in this moment. Mm-hmm. A lot of slow motion, taking in the whole crowd, really enveloping us. And I thought it was a really great image work.
There was a lot of eye candy.
Absolutely.
Even though Justin's costume was ridiculous. Did you
notice? The sleeveless shirt.
Yeah, with stripes. It was like a sailor outfit.
It was like...
He was working down at the docks earlier.
And decided to stop in for a drink and see what all the buzz is about at Babylon.
And we find out that the back room is closed. Oh, no. So, of course, Brian decides to host an orgy in his place.
Yes. I love that Justin suggested. I was like, I guess we break it in again. I was like... I'm pretty sure it's locked because what Brian did was some sort of destruction of property.
The interesting thing is Brian hosts this orgy, but Justin wasn't at the orgy. So where did Justin go? Was he studying, I think? He was at, he lives with Daphne, right?
Yes. He said he was doing, he was helping Daphne study for finals. That's why he wasn't there.
It's all Daphne's fault. The funny thing is, Brian talked about this being a 20-man orgy. I counted 22 men in that orgy. I did count them.
Okay. Oh, well, I had no doubt you would. I was wondering if he wasn't really counting himself when he said 20.
Himself and Debbie?
Yes. I think if you take out himself and Debbie, that's a 20-man orgy. So good for him. He hit that right on the nose.
It was kind of funny when Debbie was making her way through the orgy.
so casually, like, glad you're playing safe.
It's interesting that this scene immediately followed a scene with Ted, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Brian is sniffing drugs, snorting in this scene. And this immediately followed a scene of Ted doing the same thing. So we almost saw like the bad side of drugs and then Brian's happy side of drugs.
Like, I only do this for casual use compared to addiction. And I'm like, but both are not great. I would have loved if Brian was just doing poppers.
Yeah.
I would have been much more okay with that. But he said he's doing, I assume, some sort of trail mix, or maybe he was doing cocaine too.
Yeah, he's doing lines of something. I just felt like the story of Ted would have worked a lot better if it contrasted with Brian having a 22-man orgy without needing drugs.
Without needing drugs. They were all having safer sex by all wearing condoms that that was acknowledged. So that's great. But can we also get into the aftermath of said orgy when Justin finally comes in and Brian is at his kitchen counter and picks up a condom?
Yeah.
And this is where I'm like, no, I would have laid down some ground rules, like picking up after your own damn condoms.
Well, I think everybody's like found a condom someplace before, like between the wall and the bed, or they're under the pillow,
in
or
the steam room,
floating in the toilet because it didn't quite flush. And it's like, honey, don't flush it. Just wrap it up in some toilet paper and put it in the trash bin.
Yes, that's proper disposal. But this was in his kitchen.
Yeah.
This is where he, I'm assuming, eats. So I would have been like,
that's
I'm
happened
sorry.
To me before, though.
Oh, good Lord.
I found
Patrick.
One in the kitchen.
Ooh, I hope you sprayed down some Lysol afterwards.
It's where you poured your glass of wine the other day.
Fuck it.
Justin had a really curious role in this episode. There wasn't a whole lot of him until like the end. I think he had maybe 10 lines total. So that was interesting. That really stood out for me here.
Especially with him being the one that we have seen in this storyline to be the one going after Stockwell so harshly.
Yeah, he just kind of faded away.
And it allowed Brian to then step in into, as you said, that detective role.
The private dick.
The private big dick, yes.
Yeah. I like the private big dick. There's a moment in the diner that Hunter recognized Jason Kemp, aka Dumpster Boy. And this plays into why Brian is being the gumshoe. I thought this moment was interesting. He won't tell them the full story of why he knows who this kid is or who might have killed him. And I'm not sure why.
I think he makes it clear is because the person he saw him go off with, and we can get into that when we discuss the more Hunter situation, is that this guy is a cop.
The night he got killed, we were at a bar. He went off with this trick. I warned him not to, but Jason needed the money, so he went anyway. That's the last time I saw him.
Any idea who this guy was?
Why didn't you go to the police? You've got to be kidding. You never arrest him.
Why not?
You figure it out.
But why wouldn't he have just said to Debbie, oh my God, that guy was a cop? Why was there like this weird cliffhanger?
Well, there would be a lot at stake for someone who is a hustler on the street. Can he really risk his life for someone who is dead against the police force that clearly is really just watching out for their own? Like, that's a big risk for anyone to take, let alone a 16-year-old kid. That's the thing, who has yet to really learn that these are people he could trust with it.
Yeah, my note was that I didn't think that he had much to fear at that point, but you're right. If one hustler was killed by the cops.
Yeah, who's to say they won't wipe him out?
They won't find the next one.
Who does he have that's coming after him or worrying about him? Clearly no one, because he's out in the streets selling his body.
There's a bit of a gap in the story where Debbie goes to Carl and says that a cop picked up Jason Kemp. But it's a little unclear how Debbie made that connection based on what Hunter said. All Hunter said was, you figured that out.
Yes, he saw him leave with a guy.
Yeah, so that was a big jump. And I I almost think that there's a little bit of dialogue that had to be cut out of that scene there.
That would have really made the connective tissue make sense.
It became a little bit of a Teletubby moment where she telepathically knows stuff.
She's able to pick up the clues without anybody else knowing.
And then explain it to us.
Yes.
So Brian and Hunter go undercover.
And Hunter is gunning for Brian hard.
Yeah, I love that.
And I'm like, why isn't Brian thinking, you know, at the end of this, why not?
So this actually picks up when Brian zooms up in the Corvette to pick up Hunter.
Yes.
On Hooker Row in the, what was it, the warehouse district?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think Hunter was ready to do Brian for free. There was no negotiation at all before Hunter tried to climb on top of Brian in the Corvette.
And maybe he thought he was good for it because of the car.
Or did he think that he was really going to hire him? Like he came to his senses and wanted young dick?
It was very strange, but I think I remember there being dialogue that was very audibly picked up over their conversation in the car. And they're like, how about a threesome? Like, yeah. So like people wanted a piece of Brian because of the car, I think.
Oh, that car though. It's,
oh, the car is tacky.
It's an old man car. That's not like a 30-year-old,
but it says money to them at least.
True. There was some awesome music playing in the bar when they got there. It's a song called Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat. They were an 80s synth pop band from Scotland. All three of them were openly gay. This is light years ahead of Troy Sivan and his. I wrote this song about bottoming. It's like, if you're gonna write a song about bottoming, I don't think the words come into my garden should ever be in play. But anyway.
I think when we do a recap episode, we'll dedicate about 15 minutes to just let you go off on Troy Sivan.
Bronski Beat had three people in, and all three of them were gay. This particular song is about a gay teenager who left his family and hometown. It was one of the top gay anthems of the 80s, so it was sort of fitting to hear it in the Hustler bar full of older men. So once again, it was some really deep cuts that the music supervisors did here. Really like that song there. I had to look it up. I didn't remember it, and so I Shazammed it.
Shazammed, wow.
So while that song's playing, we get our first look at a awful chap named Kenneth Reichert, who sure does look scary.
I think as soon as he made his first entrance, I was like, this guy looks like a murderer.
He's played by Wayne Best. He's kind of a professional scary guy.
Yes, it was very Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs.
I looked through his credits and he has a long list of like scary, tough guy, creep you out roles. He's a great, great, great character actor.
I mean, he was selling it. Like the second he walked in, it's like, I don't like this guy. This guy is dangerous. He looks scary. I don't know if he's even blinked since he walked into this bar. I also had a question about how Hunter got into the bar.
Yeah, well, this is a Hustler bar, apparently, which I thought it was a little strange that for everyone that's in the bar, Brian would have stood out like a sore thumb when he walked in.
Yes, because he's in that in-between of he's not young enough to be the hustler that the old guys in the bar are looking for.
His strategy seemed a little unclear to me, though. What was his goal, just to ID this cop and get his name, or was he pumping him for information? What was Brian doing there?
Right. Well, and we haven't even gotten to the fact that Justin was in the bar, too.
Well, that came in later.
Oh, that comes later. Yes, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that comes later. Yeah, maybe this is like a recon for Brian. Let's first identify the guy and then see if maybe Horvath can do something or at least.
There's like
least
better ways to identify him, like ask the bartender.
Yeah. Have you seen this guy around? But then again, I mean.
He throws like $100 bills at violin players on the street. Throw a $100 bill at a bartender.
Unless there is some sort of understanding between the bartenders, say like, listen, I know what goes on here. I don't snitch on anybody. Who knows?
It's funny that I just said that because there's one of my friends used to be a bartender in a gay bar here. And I saw this new guy at a bar and I was like, wow, I really want to meet him. And I said that to my friend and he immediately like poured him a beer and sent him a beer like on my behalf.
That's amazing.
Well, and then I'm like, what? No. That's not really my style. And then I'm like, I don't even know his name. So my friend went and looked at his credit card and gave me his name.
Whoa, invasion of privacy on your friend's bar.
It was funny because the name on his credit card was John. Oh, okay. But he goes by Jack, which is pretty common.
Okay.
John F. Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, sure. That type of thing. So for the longest time, I thought that this hot guy was John. In fact, his name was Jack. Fast forward like 3 months, we had met and hung out many times. Thank you.
Including in the kitchen?
In the kitchen. Uh-huh. So Debbie gets hold of this information and heads straight to the police station.
You could at least talk to him, get a fucking description.
Someone he has it in for, chased him off his corner, harassed one of his tricks, arrested him for prostitution.
It's a fucking lead, Carl. Can't you at least follow it?
It's off my desk. Cold cased.
By who?
Higher ups.
You mean Stockwell?
That's none of your business.
Whoever killed Jason Kemp is my business. So you can tell your higher ups to get their asses down here and put it back on the front burner.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Navani, but I don't take my orders from you.
Debbie ends up talking to Vic about this, and there's something that I didn't like about what Debbie's focus was. She's complaining to Vic about Horvath looking right through her.
What is it, sis?
He looked right through me.
Who did?
Horvath, who do you think? And he called me Mrs. Navani. Like I was... a total stranger. Total fucking stranger.
She didn't care about Jason Kemp at that moment. Her concern was like, oh, I went to see Horvath and Horvath was like offhand to me. He didn't show me affection. She didn't say that, but that was the gist of it. And I couldn't help but thinking that Debbie was the most riled up about Jason Kemp, but here she just kind of forgot about that and was more like me. Granted, Jason Kemp is dead, but... I think that was unusual.
I think that's a fascinating take on it, but I didn't walk away with that thought. I think it was more clearly Horvath wants to protect someone in the precinct more than wanting to do the right thing. And I think his behavior towards Debbie is what confirmed that for her.
Yeah, to me, it just seemed sort of like...
Like when he
the
called,
elephant
like,
not in the room.
Like when he called her Mrs. Novotny and she's like, so he's not going to help me at all. He's not going to help me try and figure out who this boy was. Mm, I'm now a yeah. Mrs. Novotny.
That's a very layered look at it.
Sure.
I was yes. just seeing like Debbie's like upset that her ex beau.
Right. Because now she's like in her PJs eating Cheetos Puffs.
Yeah, watching Home Shopping.
And I'm glad Uncle Vic, who shows up with Rodney. By
yeah.
the way,
they quickly sent him upstairs. I'm going to go warm up the sheets. I love that.
This is, side note, this is the relationship I'm rooting for. I am all about the Vic and Rodney right now. And I mean, Rodney could get it.
We did find out something about Horvath, though.
Horvath's like a cheese doodle.
You told me he was well endowed.
So Vic knows that Horvath is well endowed by way of Debbie. So every time we look yes. at Carl Horvath now, Horvath, have a bath, big dick.
So if you ever see a Cheetos puff, know of... Yeah. Detective Havabath's huge dick.
So next in the storyline, Brian knows where to go to find Reichert. So he brings Justin back to the bar that night as bait.
He's going to use Justin to like...
Yeah, let me put my loved one in harm's way.
To collect some sort of evidence. So in my mind, I'm like, what are they trying to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Is Brian trying to say like, Justin, I need you to blow this guy and while his load is in your mouth, spit it into a condom and then we can positively identify him as the murderer of Jason Kemp. I think this is his thought process.
Or it was enough to try to get Reichert to come and talk to him or something like Justin was going to pump him for info or just get
it
pumped
was,
or.
Yeah, it was I think he was going to use Justin to in some way, kind of like how Justin used Kip to save Brian.
Yeah, I mean, it's
I'm going to sex you up by getting way of evidence so I can save Brian. And I'm like, what?
It's one thing to use Hunter, you know, the street hustler, because he's streetwise. He can handle himself.
Yes.
It's another thing to take your long-term boyfriend that you've saved from a gay bashing to that bar to hook up with a guy that you think murdered somebody. So Brian, bad judgment.
Absolutely.
All around. Justin said a few things here that were interesting. He's both ageist and profound, all in one paragraph.
I thought he was very sharp tongue.
Well, first he's kind of ragging on the patrons.
Look at all these old guys.
It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Some of them are even older than you are.
I guess at their age, if they want it, they gotta pay for it.
Another reason to die young.
Or to accept the fact that youth and beauty are fleeting, that time will inevitably leave its mark, and that we should accept our mortality with grace and dignity.
So as much as Justin thinks that we should accept our mortality with grace and dignity, as soon as an older man looks at him, Justin gives this kind of look.
Which is really funny considering he's with someone who's like 10 or 11 years older than him.
12?
12, yeah, sorry. Maybe. Well, they were 17 and 29, so yeah, I guess so.
There's a hilarious interaction between Justin and Hunter.
Look who's here. Come to find me.
Yeah, you're all I've been thinking about.
Fuck off.
Excuse me?
I said get lost. I saw him first.
Really?
Justin, this is Hunter. It's Michael and Ben's new foundling.
I really liked how Justin doesn't know who he is. And so
Justin's like, excuse me?
Which is interesting because this episode had a lot of humor in it, as well as some really like scary storylines. Like Kenneth Reichert is a scary dude. But,
yeah.
But at the same time, this was funny. The whole bar scene was funny.
Justin's no longer that young, unattainable twink. Yeah. Hunter's on the scene.
He's just floppy-haired blonde boy now. His hair's like super long now in this episode. There's a nice exit out of this episode as Hunter leaves with Reichert, who we now know to be a killer.
And this is where we have finally genuine stakes in this episode. Like,
yeah.
I was actually worried for Hunter and his safety, and I thought it was one hell of a cliffhanger for this episode.
It played well with Michael being at his house, having chained the door. It's like, he's not here. We have rules. He chained the door, not really knowing that Hunter just left with the murderous cop.
With the accused killer. Like, this is insane.
I remember watching it for the first time, and I thought that they were surely going to kill off Hunter. They're like, Hunter was going to be the next Jason Kemp.
He's going to be Dumpster Boy, too.
That would have been, like, pretty edgy for this show, though, because we've already gotten to know the character, whereas with Jason Kemp, he was completely anonymous. We'd never heard of this guy or seen him before, so we had no basis to be super attached Jason Kemp.
But here with Hunter, now that we've been introduced to him, he has spent his time in Ben and Michael's lives and, you know, the lives of some of the other folks, too. We now care. We are now worried. We are now almost terrified for him now that we've seen how this cop reacts to others.
I do admit being worried about the young man.
Wow.
The song Future Proof by Massive Attack was playing over this scene, and that creepy vibe just kept going up and up and up. It was overlapping with Michael at home, Hunter at the bar, in the alley, Michael like concern. I really liked that. It was a nice touch.
Yes, it was a great way to start leading us into the end of this season.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. That time again to have a listener question. Let's hear it.
My name is Elena. This is a question about season 3, episode 12. Michael and Ben start taking care of Hunter and they invite him to their house. So here are two very generous men. We can see role models in them. But realistically, would you do this? Give him a key from your house after knowing him for several days? Pay bills for his health care? I really want to say yes, because we all see that this is the right thing to do. But if I want to be honest with myself, this seems to be very admirable, but not very realistic. What do you think about this, and what would you do? Thanks.
So thank you, Elena, for your question. I also want to thank you for being such a
super fan
and a big supporter of the podcast, and always lively in our discussions on Facebook. With Elena's question, I must admit, I think there is a part of me that would absolutely be like, yes, of course I'd help someone. But realistically, and I think this is right on the money, I would be very, very hesitant to offer my home to someone that I have known for a few days.
A few minutes,
you know? It's, but, you know, someone I barely know who has been on the street, who is clearly street smart and could easily hustle me out of something so he could make a quick buck. I think we're very lucky, at least for Patrick and I in Chicago, that there are resources like the Center on Halsted, Project Fear Chicago, that offers housing to LGBTQ youth who have been removed from their homes. They are more equipped with the resources that could help someone like Hunter. And I would feel better knowing that I referred them to those organizations who are equipped to handle that kind of thing, rather than saying, well, you know what? I have a couch and here's a key and I'm going to trust that you are going to walk in and out of this place by this time and you are not going to steal any of my things and hawk it for money.
The interesting thing about that story is it seems like something that young people the same age would do. Like, as grown-ups, we're like a little more hesitant. If you think about when you were like 20, 21... We had all kinds of people staying at your place.
Yes, I was at...
I'm going to work. I'll see you later.
I was that idealistic 20-something, just moved here, and like, oh, I'll be happy to help this person out. It's like to struggle.
Well, yeah. I think at that point in people's lives, it's more about hangout and less about saving people. Like, Hunter wouldn't have been looking for a savior. He'd be looking for a place to crash, a place to wash up.
And I'll repay you with a blowjob. Yeah, and I'll repay you with a blowjob every once in a while.
Not even that. I grew up kind of as a punk rocker, and so I had kind of a punk house for a long time where bands coming to town, they need a place to crash. Yeah, you can crash in the living room. People would come and go. We had like a couple of roommates, and we had people over all the time. But again, we're like 19, 20, 21, 22, that age of you're first on your own. You're not having any rules around you. And so you're willing to like stretch.
And you have the roof over your head, but not much else. So like,
yeah, you don't have like a whole bunch of expensive shit.
Right. Now I'm like, I got a flat screen TV and I got a Nest in my house. Get the fuck away from my shit. You know?
Did you touch the thermostat? I set it there for a reason, young man.
My phone just went off. What happened? What'd you do?
Ah, the good old days.
Mm-hmm. Again, Elena, thank you for the question. And again, if you want to have a question answered on the podcast, make sure you check out our website, stillqueerasfolk.com/hello. We'd love to hear from you.
You can submit a voicemail or you can submit a written question if you don't want to leave us a voicemail.
Still Queer as Folk.
So the B story in this episode, I gave it to Ted and Emmett. There's some, I don't know, some awkward writing here, but I like this story. Emmett still hasn't heard from Ted, so he's doing busy work around Ted's condo. But why was he listening to the Queen of the Night aria from the Magic Flute while he was doing that? Is this just a case of opera? Because Ted likes opera, so...
So trying to harken back to something he would find comforting in some way?
Yeah.
Like Ted is almost there. But I thought Peter Page did such a fantastic job when Mel and Lindsay came to visit. And he sort of let loose the gates of he disappeared. I don't know where he is.
Well, first he lied to them.
Yes. First he tries to cover for Ted, but then breaks down. And I think that was such a heartbreaking thing to watch for Emmett.
He also eventually puts the college fund back and the lesbians notice.
Yes, I think that's also part of their visit, is that they noticed that one second it was there, the next it's gone, it's back.
I thought it was a little bit of awkward writing where Emmett gets a phone call in front of the lesbians. It was just kind of a silly gimmick because it was Vic calling. So yes, he steps into the kitchen to have a conversation with Vic. I don't know, I haven't heard from him. It's like, they are in the room, they hear you.
Well, yeah, and they immediately catch him in his lies. Like, I thought he was getting his tires. Nah.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was like, what? Awkward writing, because there's better ways to introduce it than like an accidental exposure to a phone call.
That Emmett's just blatantly throwing out whatever lie he can possibly figure out. I feel like that cheapens what Emmett is going through.
By the way, don't forget that Melanie's pregnant. Not even mentioned in this episode.
Oh, right.
Remember, she's supposed to be taking it easy and everything?
They made such a big deal about her taking on that big case.
Yeah, she's very not pregnant in this episode. So Ted had his lost weekend. Emmett was strangely put together during their initial confrontation.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. I needed to get away.
Well, you could have at least told me you were going. Why didn't you call or leave a message? You know, did it occur to you that I might be scared out of my mind?
Of course it did. I meant to call. I wasn't in a very good place.
Funny, I've always heard Palm Springs was a very good place.
I think I would have been beside myself, yelling and screaming, tearing up the place.
Where the fuck were you? What did you do? Why did you steal this money? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why did you go? Why didn't you tell me?
I would have been hysterical.
A thousand questions. I would have been smacking him and like, what is wrong with you? And just breaking down and having a whole moment. But Emmett is just sort of had fallen asleep on the couch, and Ted comes back and he's like, where were you? I don't know if there was some sort of like, maybe this is something Emmett related to and recognized and said, I know I can't go on a rage against this. I don't know. It was very strange. It was very
I tried to tear it apart. And the only thing I could think of is that less is more in this particular scene. So I think it would have been very predictable if Emmett went batshit crazy over it. So I kind of like Peter Page's delivery where he's asleep. Ted doesn't know that he saw him. He's like, where the fuck have you been? So it was a deep acting moment.
Yes, it's very much playing the opposite.
I still struggle with Emmett paying that money back, though. I don't quite get why he would do that.
It harkens back to the whole lovers are going to cover lovers, the way Michael was covering for Ben and his steroid use. I see a lot of parallels because they're all like, I'm worried for my lover. I just want to make sure that he's okay. So I'm going to do what I need to make sure that he is okay.
I can't see myself doing that like stealthily.
No.
I could see myself doing it as Ted comes clean and says, yes, I took the money. And I could see myself doing it by saying, I understand the money's gone. I will give Melanie and Lindsay their $5,000 back and you will pay me back with interest.
Yes.
I can see that. But to just take the money and mysteriously put it into the account, not tell Mel and Lindsay, not tell Ted. I just thought that was a little bit strange.
Yes. And it screws over his partner in all this, Vic.
Yeah, totally. They were going to get an oven.
They were going to get an oven to handle all of the parties that they are doing. So really more people are getting harmed in all of this.
Did you believe Ted when he was telling Emmett that he had his last weekend and was going to start anew tomorrow?
Hey, guys. Teddy.
Hi, Michael.
Are you okay?
Listen, if you ever want to get together and just talk things out.
Thanks, Michael, but I've had my last weekend and it's over.
Not for one goddamn second.
Yeah, me either. It just had so many addict words in it. I just found it really unsettling.
Right. I just needed this one last one and I'm going to be fine now. I'm going to make it through. And that's
like, we know what's going on.
And this is why I had so much trouble with what's going on because one, like Ted survived an overdose already. He was in a coma.
I forgot about that.
He was in a coma within the first three episodes of this series. And now he's doing meth and all this other stuff, and he's having graphic anonymous sex with all these people.
The entire white party, we're led to believe.
Yes, the entire white party. And then for him and Emmett to want to reconnect, and Emmett says, like, well, I'm here now, so let's have our sexual relation. And it's like throwing Ted off. Like I was trying to figure this out. Was he having trouble performing because of he wasn't on any drugs, or was he just strung out and like detoxing in a way?
You mean when he was trying to hook up with Emmett?
Yes.
I think that's full on addict mode. It's like once you've had Crystal, Tina, Skeen, you see these people that just can't get enough of it after that. Mm-hmm. So I thought that this portrayal of Ted here as being the crystal meth sex addict was pretty accurate. I mean, we see it all the time on Grindr, Chappie. Scruff.
PNP.
Yeah. And that type of thing. So what's you come hooked on that stuff. You just can't do it otherwise because it's lacking. And that's one of the nasty things about Crystal is it totally changes your entire perception of what sex is and what the joy of it can be. It becomes much more mechanical and artificial.
It was almost disturbing then in that moment for Ted to then pull out this box.
I called it his gearbox.
That so happened to have a little bit of drugs left.
A little bit.
And he decides
that was the works.
Yeah, it was the works. And he decides, I'm going to do it. And then he's trying to convince Emmett. And Emmett even mentions, like, in my wayward youth, yes, I've done this and I have no interest in doing this again. But he still does the drugs.
And here, the magic flute was playing again when they were having their little romantic evening alone that led to this. So the symbolism here was very strong. In the opera, The Magic Flute, the Queen of the Night persuades a strapping fella named Tamino to rescue her daughter, Amina, from the evil priest Sarastro. But Tamino likes Sarastro's cult and wants to join in. So to gain acceptance, these two go through a set of initiations, first alone and then together, which eventually kills off the Queen of the Night. There's some other characters in The Magic Flute, but I think Ted and Emmett are really playing out Tamino and Pamina's story here, which is that they have to go through these great trials in order to be together.
Fascinating. Every time you say Queen of the Night, I think of the bodyguard in Whitney Houston, but...
I'm the Queen of the Night!
Yes! Sing it, Patrick!
I had to stretch here because I was looking for some reason that they kept playing the magic flute and the Queen of the Night aria. So to get Ted to take a snort, it just seemed like there was something there. It was good writing, though, to see Emmett falling into that temporary pleasure of Crystal. As soon as he took his little hit, he was like, woo.
He's like, now I'm ready to pound the hell out of Emmett.
There's also a part earlier that we didn't talk about, which is Ted's big apology moment with Melanie and Lindsay. Melanie's lines here were good.
Do you have any idea how hard that was for him?
I know. I feel so bad for him.
I don't. He's a fucking drug user.
That is not true. He tried it once.
I'm off it, Emmett. For him to get to the point where he'd actually steal our money.
He didn't steal it. He borrowed it. He was planning on putting it back.
And you believe him?
Don't you? I thought you were his friends.
We are his friends.
Damn good friends.
Then why can't you show him the teeniest, tiniest bit of compassion?
Because he'd only abuse it and us.
Mel.
The same way he's abusing you.
He is not abusing me.
What do you call it?
He is counting on me to be there for him, to believe in him, to help him put his life back in order.
Could you stop being a silly faggot and have some balls, for Christ's sakes?
Well, I may be a silly faggot, but you know something, Mel? You're a cunt.
Yes, I thought
she knows what's up.
She was cutting through the bullshit.
Yeah, when it comes to dealing with an addict, she's down. Ted accepts these. Okay, we'll wait and see. But Emmett seemed to think that just saying sorry was enough. I'm sorry I took $5,000 from you and ran away and put it up my nose.
And yeah, and went on this bender where I didn't tell anybody where I was going.
Yeah, I don't know why Emmett thought that was like, he said he's sorry.
This is Emmett not wanting to really face the truth of what he's dealing with.
Yeah, I just can't imagine putting myself into... I can't imagine compromising myself that much for somebody that I'm seeing that is going down the rabbit hole of crystal meth. I just wouldn't do it.
And considering that Emmett can recognize the behavior...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he knows what's going on.
That he wouldn't want to say, you're right, we need to do something... That is the correct way to deal with him. We need an intervention. We need to put him in rehab. We need to do something now, which clearly we know.
They're all friends. It's like, come on.
Yes. And for Emmett to then later on say, like, some friends they are. I'm like, Emmett, really? Are you going to be this blind to what's going on with Ted?
But first, I didn't like how it got to Melanie and Emmett trading insults.
Mm.
You're a cunt. You're a faggot. But when I watched it the second time, I really, really liked that exchange. I'm not quite sure why Emmett would follow Ted into the abyss like that, but I love that Melanie sees through it and just sticks to her guns the whole way.
Yes. And I'm like, she knows what needs to happen in order to save Ted. So she's not going to back down. And I thought that was really great.
When we saw Vic uncharacteristically naive about Ted when he was talking to Emmett in the French grocery.
How's he doing?
Well, he's been through a lot, poor baby. But he's back now. That's all I care about. Well...
I'd keep an eye on him, just in case.
You know, I'm getting a little sick of everyone telling me what I should do and what they would do. So we went to a fucking circuit party, like every other faggot in the world. It's not like all of a sudden he's a crystal queen.
I'm just saying it may be a while until he's himself again.
You thought he was naive?
Well, He said that it might be a while before Ted is himself again. I feel like Vic should have known better, though, in this case. He seemed to be halfway buying what Emmett was selling about Ted getting this one circuit party out of his system.
Oh, see, I thought Vic was, and maybe this is because I believe Vic to be very savvy. I thought he was well aware of what was going on and was trying to sort of carefully approach the subject with Emmett and saying that when you say that it's going to take a while for him to get this out of his system, I thought he was talking literally like he's clearly high on shit. It's going to take him a while to come down and get that flushed out of his system.
Yeah, maybe I just wish that Vic might have been a little more specific about it.
Well, here's the thing, though, is that we saw exactly what happened when Mel was being a little more specific with Emmett. Yeah. And so Vic, being the sage, wise one, I think, of the series, was trying to handle it in a delicate manner to try and get the same kind of result that Mel ended up getting. I think we saw two sides of how to handle it.
Still queer as folk.
So there's some miscellaneous Hunter cleanup details to cover. Michael is in full-on mom mode over Hunter in his intro.
Picking up his laundry, you know, the clothes that he just has strewn throughout the home.
Did you notice that Michael woke him up by grabbing and shaking his butt?
Oh, I thought he was just grabbing his leg. He's just like,
that hey, looked like his butt to me.
Eh.
Hunter sure is making himself at home there. That was quick.
Hunter has made himself at home, and it's really great.
There was that quick scene where Hunter met Brian at the comic shop. That was really cute.
Like, yeah. Oh, my God.
Winking at him.
And I was like, Hunter is hunting. Mm-hmm.
They go to bed at 9, but I stay up late.
This the kid?
Hunter, this is Brian.
Want to fuck? Nice to meet you, too.
Now go do something useful.
I was trying to.
I like Brian's kind of response to
it. Yes, it was more like I was trying to figure out if Brian was amused by Hunter. It was like, look at him trying so hard or what. I was like, is Brian flattered? Is he humored? Is he like, why is this kid bothering me?
Yeah. Poor Ben had some performance problems whilst topping Michael, all because of Hunter. There was something here that I picked up on. I don't know if you saw it, but when Ben peels off of the top of Michael, he's got something in his hand that looked like poppers.
Thank you.
Did you
yes.
see it?
Yes, I did.
You did?
Yes. I was like, at first I thought, oh, maybe that's the condom that he was trying to, like, he was going to get ready to put it on.
Maybe it was the microphone. Well, they were naked.
That's true.
So maybe they didn't have a boom operator
that
day.
They had to have had a boom operator in that moment. But no, I think.
Yeah, what was that?
I thought it was a condom wrapper, and he was just like getting ready to put it on. But I like the idea that it was the poppers.
I think it was. We'll take a screenshot. Detail. We'll take a screenshot. Yeah. We'll post it with this episode, and we'll get some fan feedback from what could that have been in Ben's hand. So Michael, strangely, is the one that volunteers the key to Hunter. What ilk could that have come from? It's
like, I couldn't quite figure that out because I thought Michael was absolutely correct in this. And I felt Ben was being very naive with Hunter and like giving him carte blanche to the house. I mean,
yeah, well, guess what happens?
He just
they might as well have been in Florida.
Yeah.
So of course he gets caught in the act. And of course his client is suitably high school principal looking.
Oh my God.
I felt that was a little over the top casting there.
Yes, to say like let's come up with the homeliest person that Hunter could have picked up.
Having known several escorts in my life, they have told me that their clientele is across the board. That there is no one type that sees an escort. And in this show and in this story arc, the escorts are always portrayed as these kind of dismal looking, out of shape, older men. And my escort friends tell me that that's certainly not the case.
I'm sure they get a lot of clients who take care of themselves and look great and are just looking for the company of someone.
Pretty woman, Richard Gere.
Woof.
There's a weird little angsty scene from Hunter after he walks out of the apartment. I thought that was a little Degrassi-esque, where he's all the way back to the warehouse district. He's screaming and yelling and slamming himself into the chain link fence.
It very much reminded me. This is a deep cut, I think, even for me, Patrick. There's a musical called The Life.
came out in the 90s, and it's about hookers and pimps in New York before it got clean for the tourists. And there's a song called Someday is for Suckers.
I'm sick and tired of working in this hellhole of a place with broken glass and used up rubbers on the ground.
Yes, in that instance, yes.
You should mail me a copy of this.
Okay.
I'll have the mailman deliver
it
to
us. But it's a great song where they're talking about like all the things that they thought they could do and how like their dreams are all they have and there's no way they're going to get out of their situation because someday is for suckers for people like them. And it's great. But in my head, that song came in as Hunter was having his meltdown in the warehouse district, not picking up any clients.
Yeah, that's not the way to pick them up.
No, screaming around like you were.
So something I'm a little unclear about is why they gave Hunter a key to come and go, but then set the chain on the door so that he can't actually use the key.
Well, they made a specific saying like you can only be out until midnight.
So, okay. So he's going to come home late. He's not going to have anywhere else to go. So he's going to unlock the door, push it open. And then the chain will go thunk. And then he'll be like, he can get his arm into the apartment. He can like yell and scream at him and stuff like that. So
they were putting it on after midnight though.
But still, it's like, it just seemed strange. It's like you can come and go as you want, but we're going to set the chain because we set this boundary, but you can still get the door open a little bit.
That's a very fair point, because why were they staying up for him? Well,
it needed, instead of like a chain or something, it needed like an extra deadbolt.
Yeah.
Like a bar.
Click.
Yeah. Put the bar in the door, Ben. Okay. So let's talk hits and misses for this episode. What was your hit?
My hit was that cliffhanger at the end with Hunter and the cop. I thought it did a great job of building the suspense, putting a character that we're now starting to get invested in, but because he's still very new to the series, we don't know how it's going to turn out. Like, it would have been one thing if it was Justin doing it, because we're like, well,
right.
he's going to be
sacrifice
fine.
Justin.
Yeah, he's going to be fine. But let's throw in a character that we've only seen for a few episodes, and now we're understanding his stakes in the story. I thought that was very smart and ended on a way of like, I have to know what happens next.
It's funny that you say that, because I still think that it would have been a tremendous show moment to have killed him off at that point, or at least had Kenneth Reichert kill one more person, like somebody that we knew, maybe not Hunter, but
I worry that then it would get a little CSI
serial,
on me.
Yeah, serial killer.
or Law and Order on me.
Mariska Hargitay comes in.
Womp womp. So.
So my hit in this episode was the music.
Oh.
It was really well scored and had music from The Prodigy, Bronski Beat, Massive Attack, and Mozart. So I couldn't have asked for more. I loved it.
A wide variety. It's great. So my miss for this episode is that that final moment that we have with Emmett and Ted in bed, where Emmett decides to do the drugs as well. I was in utter disbelief that he did that, considering that we know Emmett to be much more wise and smarter than that to then sacrifice his health in that way made no sense. And it was a disappointing moment for me for Emmett.
My miss was the Ben, Michael, and Hunter strife. I didn't think that really needed to be in this episode. It was good story fodder, but it was just distracting from the more powerful Hunter, Brian, and Reichert story. Mm. I think it would have been better if those bits were saved for a separate episode that could have focused on Hunter in the A story. So this has been episode 12 of season 3, Drugs, Sex, and Lies.
Next time, Justin may face expulsion for designing anti-Stockwell posters.
Hunter goes undercover to collect evidence for Brian. For Brian.
And Emmett has had it with Ted's drug use.
That will be episode 13 of season 3, and it's called Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen.
Damn, that's a title.
Yeah.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk, where you can continue on the discussion.
I'm on Instagram at Patrick Randall, and would love to connect with all of you.
And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us, please give us a positive review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still queer as folk.